Good morning, Oregon. I'm Finn J.D. John, Finn at OffbeatOregon.com, and this is the Daily Offbeat Oregon History Podcast. Thank you for loading me down and queuing me up, and I hope you enjoy the show. You might not think a fire on a riverboat would be that big a deal. After all, it's only a river, right? But fire on a riverboat was a very serious matter. The stories of paddle wheel riverboats on American rivers are peppered with tales of fire. And nearly all of them come with a body count. Oregon's most famous riverboat fire has a body count, too. It's one, but it would have been quite a lot higher if it hadn't been for the quick thinking of its legendary skipper. Here's how it went down. First, a little bit about the boat. When it was launched in 1884, the sternwheeler Telephone was the fastest boat on the Columbia. Telephone sounds like a pretty boring name for a riverboat, but you have to remember the telephone had just been invented in 1876. It was a pretty new and big deal at the time. Of course, the telephone enabled instant communications, and correspondingly, the telephone was the fastest boat on the Columbia. Possibly the fastest in the country. With steam up, this rakish, palatial vessel could do considerably better than 20 miles an hour. Its owner and designer and skipper was the already legendary Uriah B. Scott, the guy who brought true shallow draft riverboats to the Willamette River and later ate the lunch of Henry Villard's would-be steamboat monopoly on the Portland to Astoria run with his other steamer, the Fleetwood. Well, the telephone was even faster than the Fleetwood, and that was saying something. That speed would turn out to be vitally important on one particular voyage on November 20th, 1887. On that day, the telephone was steaming toward Astoria as usual when Scott got a terse message over the speaking tube from the engine room. "Engine room's afire," the engineer reported. "It's driving us away from the engines." Scott now had a choice to make, and he had to make it in the next few seconds. He could muster the crew and try to put the fire out, or he could turn and make for shore at top speed. If he tried to fight the fire, he could possibly save the telephone, a very valuable piece of naval architecture indeed. And of course, if all went well, he could then continue to Astoria and deliver his passengers as usual. But to do this and have any chance of success, he'd have to kill the engine so the wind created by the speed of the telephone wouldn't fan the flames. That meant if firefighting efforts didn't go well, they'd be stuck in the middle of the widest part of the Columbia River while the boat burned to the waterline and sank. Yes, there would be lifeboats in the water, but people would die. They always did. Decks collapsed under them. They became overcome with smoke. They panicked and jumped overboard and drowned. Or maybe they just died of hypothermia in the chilly November river water. There were 140 of them. Some of them would die. And if the crew lost that fight with the fire, the end would come fast. Riverboats like the telephone were made, of course, of wood. The wood was kept carefully dry to prevent rot and usually pickled in varnishes and flammable paints, which, even after they dry out, help the wood catch fire and burn and make the smoke deadlier, too. Captain Scott was an old riverboat man. He knew what happens when one starts to burn. And he was probably especially familiar with the worst-case scenario. That is, he knew what had happened to the Eliza Battle a couple dozen years before in Indiana. Efforts to fight that fire failed, and by the time the skipper realized he needed to make for shore, the rudder ropes had burned through and the boat could not be steered. 80 people died on the Eliza Battle, and another 100 were badly hurt while the boat blindly thrashed down the river. If Scott opted to fight the fire, he might save the ship. Or he might end up presiding over another Eliza Battle scenario, and if he survived, be forever haunted by the sense of having staked his passengers' lives on a gamble to save his ship, and lost. The alternative was to make for shore with all possible speed. This would involve sacrificing any possibility of saving the boat. The wind created by the telephone's speed would fan the flames to an inferno, and by the time the boat hit the beach, there would be nothing to do but watch her burn. Then, too, it was not clear that the telephone could make it to shore in time. The telephone could hardly have picked a worse place to catch fire. It was most of the way to Astoria when this happened, and the river was almost 5 miles wide. Scott had a good 2 miles of open water to cross, and he had to do it before the fire spread enough to start killing people. Could he make it? Maybe not. So, stay and try to save the boat, or run for shore and try to save the passengers. This doesn't seem to have been a hard decision for Captain Scott. He didn't even hesitate. "Put her full speed ahead," he barked back into the speaking tube, and put the helm hard aport. The telephone heeled over hard as the paddle wheel's thrashing intensified and Scott strained to hold the rudder over. Around the slim vessel came till its nose was pointing straight at the state of Oregon. The engine room black crew, having opened up the steam as wide as it would go, hustled up through the smoke and fire to the top deck, where passengers were already clustered around the least fiery end of the boat, that is, the one closest to shore, the bow. From the pilot house, Scott could look ahead at the patch of deck farthest from the flames, at the very bow of the boat, where the wind was sweeping the flames back and away. Soon, everything behind and around his pilot house was on fire. The rudder ropes had probably gone by now. In moments, the boat would be fully engulfed, and anyone still on deck at that time would start dying. But he could see his gamble in making full speed for shore was going to pay off. The telephone was going to make it in time. Nobody was checking, of course, but it's a safe bet that the telephone was moving faster than it ever had before, or would again. In a few moments, it would be connecting with the riverbank at 20+. The passengers packed into the bow braced for impact as best they could. Then the telephone fetched up on the Oregon side of the river, traveling at maximum speed. Luckily, there was a gentle mud flat there, and it buffered the impact. Still, the telephone dealt the state of Oregon a mighty blow, and passengers went flying to the rapidly heating up foredeck. There were probably some injuries, the record doesn't say about that. Whatever those injuries may have been, though, they weren't enough to keep a single passenger on that by now dangerously hot deck once that boat hit the shore. Over the gunwales they went, splashing into the water and mud and clambering up on shore to watch the telephone burn. After watching the last of the passengers disembark, Scott turned to leave but found to his consternation that the fire was surrounding the pilot house and had burned away the steps. So he opened the pilot house window and bailed out. Most sources say he executed a swan dive, but this seems rather unlikely given that the telephone was stuck in mud on the shore. More likely it was something more along the order of a belly flop or a cannonball. The telephone burned to the waterline as the passengers watched and the firefighters from Astoria did what they could. When it was all done, they found one single body in the wreckage, that of an unfortunate fellow who had just picked a really bad time to get drunk, and had either passed out or been too befuddled to find his way upstairs. Everyone else made it. The telephone was rebuilt, and continued to work the Astoria run for many years after that. It enjoyed a reputation for blinding speed right up until it was scrapped in 1918. But the rebuilt telephone was never as fast as the original telephone was. Luckily, it never had to be. This story was first published on November 6th of 2011 under the headline, "Captain's Quick Decision Saved Hundreds from a Fiery Death." Key sources included works by E.W. Wright, Gordon Newell, and Don Marshall. Well, that's our show for today. Thanks again for listening, and I hope you enjoyed it. This podcast is part of Offbeat Oregon History, a public history resource for the state we love. Check out our hub page at offbeatoregon.com to explore all the other things we do. You'll also find there visuals to go with today's story and also full citations to the sources for this story. This podcast is covered under a Creative Commons license. For the details of that, see offbeatoregon.com/cc. Our theme music is by the Atlas String Band and was written by Carmen Ficarra. Listen and download more at atlasstringband.com. Got an idea for a show I should do? Drop me a line at finn@offbeatoregon.com. Also, let me know if you're ever going to be in Corvallis with the time for a cup of coffee or a pint of Hammerhead. Fresh episodes of Offbeat Oregon History come your way at around 6 a.m. every weekday morning, so if you're looking forward to the next one already, you haven't got long to wait. Until then, go out and fill up the rest of today with good stuff. Bye now.